Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Eric Klein, attorney registration number 42185, and I represent Mr. Tony Singleton in this criminal appeal. Mr. Singleton's trial was marred by constitutional error from the beginning of the trial until the very end. It began with the improper use of a peremptory challenge against an African-American juror in violation of Batson versus Kentucky, and it ended with Mr. Singleton being excluded from a critical stage of trial. And I'd like to first address briefly his exclusion from the critical stage of trial and then discuss the Batson violation. Mr. Singleton had a constitutional right to be present at all critical stages. And in People v. Grace, this court said very clearly that the discussion of juror question is a critical stage, and that's consistent with the Colorado Supreme Court's decision in Key.
Counsel, in this case, counsels for Mr. Singleton specifically indicated that he didn't need his client there. Why shouldn't the trial court be allowed to rely on that representation?
Well, I think that this court said in the Liu case that, and said very clearly, that counsel cannot waive his client's presence, that only the client, the defendant himself, can waive his presence. Here there was absolutely no indication that Mr. Singleton had communicated to counsel that he did not wish to be present or in any way consented to not being present. In fact, the answer to the second jury note, in addressing the second jury note, counsel said, I'll paraphrase something along the lines of, this is another one we don't need Mr. Singleton for. In no way ever gave any indication that Mr. Singleton had said he did not wish to be present. And this is something I think I can say as a trial lawyer, judges are constantly asking when we break and the jury goes to deliberate, if there are jury notes, does your client wish to be present, and asks that before the defendant is taken away in custody or leaves the courtroom. And that's a very simple thing to do, and that's something that this court said very clearly in lieu was required, that the counsel cannot waive his client's presence. And so I think that given that there is a constitutional violation here, the only question is can this court say beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless? And the standard that the government seems to argue for seems to flip the burden on its head and require the defense to show prejudice, the defense to show that he was, what would have been done differently. But given that it's constitutional error, the question is, can the prosecution, can the government establish beyond a reasonable doubt that it was harmless? And this is a case where I think there's two things that raise a reasonable doubt regarding harm. One is the answer to the jury questions. This was an issue regarding complicity. The jury asked very specific questions, and the answer was merely to refer the jurors back to the complicity instruction, which we discussed quite at length in our brief, merely parroted the pre-Bogdanov instruction that was erroneous.
I'm not questioning that it wasn't an important question, but what would the client have been able to do? I mean, I don't know. Did the client have some insights into the complicity instruction, complicity law that he could have shared with the counsel? I mean, is there anything in the record on that?
Well, it's clear the counsel didn't show great insight into the complicity law, although citing Bogdanov at one point. It's really my second point, Jan, which is that Mr. Singleton was somebody who was very involved in his own case. He had proceeded pro se. It's difficult for me to say what he could have or would have done because he wasn't there, and we'll never know. But the fact is, this is not your run-of-the-mill defendant who has relied on his counsel throughout. This is somebody who conducted his own preliminary hearing. This is somebody who showed a willing to at least become familiar with the law by filing his own motions. And Mr. Singleton could have said, when the jury starts focusing and twice focuses on complicity, hey, don't they need to show that I wanted this crime to be complete, not just that I was there and that my presence, as the prosecution said in voir dire, the mere presence could be sufficient for complicity and a failure to interfere or a failure to call the police, that Mr. Singleton could have said, this is something that you need to address closer, you need to take a closer look at, even if it was just saying, Really, you're just going to refer them back to that instruction? Don't you need to say something more? It might have, given that counsel did show familiarity with Bogdanov, I think that's the third different pronunciation I've given to that case now, that it might have at least called the red flag the issue for defense counsel. And I think that the danger, especially with a defendant like Tony Singleton, is failing to recognize or eliminating the distinction between the right of the defendant to personally be present and the right of the defendant to be present through counsel. And I think this court has said very clearly in Lew and Grace and other cases, those are two distinct concepts, and that a defendant does have a constitutional right to be personally present. And if there's, unless there's other questions on this issue, I would like to pivot to our Batson issue. The prosecution used its third strike to get rid of the only African-American then on the panel. And each reason proffered by the prosecutor for that strike was either refuted by the record, applied equally to similarly situated white jurors, or was not specifically credited by the trial judge. And those are factors that the U.S. Supreme Court has looked at in Miller L. and Snyder, and that this court has looked at in Collins, Gabler, and most recently Wilson, to say that is an improper challenge and that this court reverses where those factors are present. The prosecutor gave, as I break down, in three reasons for the strike. One was that he discussed what he said were various topics with the juror and that she appeared confused. The other was that she gave answers that did not match up with his questions. And the third was a kind of vague, she did not seem to be tracking. The first reason that the prosecutor discussed various topics with her and she appeared confused is completely refuted by the record. He did not discuss various topics with her in the first instance. There were two questions the prosecutor asked the juror, and she responded directly to them, and they were on a single topic. And the juror expressed no more confusion, and we're talking about reasonable doubt, which this court and many other appellate courts have said are confusing topics. But the juror showed no confusion whatsoever, actually. She expressed very clearly that, and accurately, that the prosecution's burden is not to prove guilt beyond a shadow of a doubt. There were other...
Actually, she said that the judge said that she shouldn't be proving things beyond a shadow of a doubt, right?
Right.
And the judge didn't say that, correct?
Right. The judge has said that the prosecution's burden was that a reasonable doubt is not a vague, speculative, or imaginary doubt. That was as much as being talked about, in that it was a doubt based upon reason that would cause reasonable people to hesitate to act in matters of importance to themselves. But the principle of reasonable doubt was articulated clearly by the juror. If the prosecutor truly was concerned that the juror was confused, then the prosecutor, as stated by the U.S. Supreme Court in Miller L., should have followed up. If this was something that the prosecutor truly had a concern about, you would have expected him to follow up and say, "Juror JL, do you understand what my burden is?" But that was the end of it, and there were no further questions by the juror, by the prosecutor. There were, however, other similarly situated white jurors who expressed confusion on proof beyond reasonable doubt, as well as on other important issues like complicity. And there was the one juror that I talked about repeatedly in our briefs who said, "I can never be convinced of something beyond all doubt, because even that the sun will rise in the east tomorrow, because a, I don't know if it's a typo or what she said, steroid could hit the earth and cause us to reverse course the next morning." Now, if that juror is more rational than juror JL, who said, "The judge tells me you don't have to prove this case beyond a shadow of a doubt," that just simply cannot be true. There was another juror who, when the prosecutor was asking about proof beyond reasonable doubt, said that she had, or possibly he, had, I think, tuned out. And the prosecutor did not have concerns about that juror, such to strike that juror. And as defense counsel at trial argued very clearly to the trial court, the record belies the reasons stated by the prosecution. The second reason articulated by the prosecutor was her answers did not match up with the questions. Again, this is refuted by the record. Any questions that were asked, she responded directly to. And as far as confusion, if I could back up, because juror JL, who during defense voir dire, when the defense is talking about the standard of proof and talking about the instructions that the jury would get from the trial court, juror JL said, if what you say is different than what the judge says, who are we supposed to listen to? And at that point, the jury had not been told by the trial court, my instructions are what would govern. And so it was juror JL who, if anything, was trying to clear up confusion. And the last reason given by the prosecutor is that she did not seem to be tracking. And this reason, which is extremely vague, was never directly or specifically credited by the trial court. And as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Snyder and this court said in Collins, that where the district court makes no finding crediting the stated reasons, this court cannot presume that the trial court, in fact, did so. And that's different than the Illinois case that the government relies on.
But in concluding that there was no proof that the prosecution engaged in purposeful discrimination, isn't the trial court effectively accepting the reasons that the prosecution is given, at least one of the three? I mean, he doesn't have to accept all three, right? I mean, he can just accept one of the three.
But that's the problem, Your Honor, is that the trial court never actually did that. And the trial court kind of punted the decision at this third step of the Batson analysis and said, well, I found that there's another African-American on the juror, and so that's on the jury, and that's good enough. And that's been specifically rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in Miller L. and by this court in Collins. And in Collins, this court specifically, a division of this court, distinguished the McCoy decision that the government relies on, saying there the trial court did specifically credit at least one of the reasons given by the prosecution. And so this disparate impact analysis is kind of gravy. But here, that cannot be the only analysis. And any analysis the trial court did about the credibility, the trial court started doing at step two analysis, but then again seemed to say, I'm not going to decide this issue because I see that another African American was seated. I think a couple of things that are telling here, in addition to the failure of the prosecutor to follow up, are the prosecutor made a first step challenge, or disputed the first step of the Batson analysis, and said, I think actually it has to be a showing of a pattern by the defense, and it cannot be a single juror. And because there's only been one African-American sitting here, there's no pattern. And that's something that the U.S. Supreme Court said in Hernandez was noteworthy, was that the prosecutor did not challenge the first step analysis. I have 2 minutes left, and I would like to reserve time for rebuttal, so unless there's further questions at this time, I will reserve the rest of my time.
Time is reserved.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I would like to just briefly address the defendant's argument that he was denied his right to be present at a critical stage, and then I'll move on to address the Batson issue. A defendant only has the right to be present at a critical stage if his presence is not of useless or nebulous benefit. Here, the issues that were raised during the discussion of the jury questions were strictly legal issues. The responses given by the trial court were correct. And I'd also like to point out that the questions both related to complicity. And the prosecution argued that the defendant was guilty based on a complicity theory with respect to the assault charge, of which the defendant was acquitted. In this case, he was only convicted of the menacing count, and the prosecution argued specifically that the defendant was guilty of menacing as a principal. So to the extent that there was any error at all, it did not affect the defendant's conviction on the menacing count, which is the only conviction that the defendant received in this case. If the court has no further questions on that issue, I'll address the Batson challenge. Now, in reviewing the third step of the Batson analysis, this court must give deference to the trial court's findings. and only reverses where there is a showing of clear error. Now, in this case, the prosecutor stated that his race-neutral reason was that this juror seemed surprised when she was called on. She seemed confused. The prosecutor stated that he, as well as his advisory witness, noticed that she did not seem to be tracking what was going on. She couldn't tell if, or he couldn't tell if she wasn't paying attention or if she just wasn't understanding. And he had stated that he needed someone who could pay attention to the evidence and apply the principles that the court was going to provide the jury.
Counsel, but in addition to the reasons that are proffered by the prosecution, don't we need a record showing which reasons or, you know, whether the court even accepted those as having some credibility? And isn't that something that's lacking here?
I agree that it is, in fact, required. I do not believe that it's lacking in this case. I think that the trial court specifically did credit the prosecutor's stated reasons in this case. Specifically, the court stated that she did appear to not necessarily understand the point between beyond a shadow of a doubt and beyond a reasonable doubt. The court specifically credited what the prosecutor said there when it said that she did appear to the court as well to not understand that distinction. So the court did, in fact, on the record, credit the reason provided by the prosecutor for his Batson challenge.
A question. I will say it for, right off. I'm skeptical of the prosecutor's conduct here. The prosecutor is asking this woman whether she heard the judge talk about beyond a shadow of a doubt. Did the judge talk about beyond a shadow of a doubt?
I am not sure, and I don't have that portion of the voir dire in front of me, so I'm not sure if the court specifically used those words in addressing the jurors or if that was something that came up during the voir dire.
There is no record to indicate that the court said that. Why would a prosecutor ask a juror whether they heard something the judge did not say?
Well, it's possible that the prosecutor simply misspoke and meant whether the juror had heard someone else mention that during the discussion, maybe to see if the juror was in fact paying attention.
So kind of a trick question to see if the witness was paying attention, attribute something to the judge that wasn't done.
But again, so it could be any of those reasons.
So I will tell you, first of all, that to the extent it's a trick question, that inures to the benefit of the defendant, not to the benefit of the state. Second of all, to the extent that the prosecutor misspoke, then should we hold it against the juror when she accepts what he says and responds to what he says, believing that he had accurately depicted what the judge said? Is there anything wrong with the juror trusting the prosecutor to have correctly and accurately stated what the judge had said?
But again, I don't think it's clear from the record that the juror did understand the difference. The prosecutor asked about whether or not the judge made this statement, and the juror said yes, and then the prosecutor asked again, what did he say? At which point she said that you should not make your conclusions beyond a shadow of a doubt. However, the prosecutor then followed up again with the juror to go over this again, and that may be due to the body language or demeanor that the juror was exhibiting. And that was part of the reason that the juror was struck in the first place, was because she didn't seem to be following. She appeared confused. So even if she said this, it may be that the prosecutor wasn't convinced that she was understanding or that that's what she believed, and then followed up with her again.
And how did the prosecutor do so?
The prosecutor, after he asked about whether the juror had heard the judge, went on to state, did anybody else hear shadow of a doubt? Did everybody else hear reasonable doubt? And then specifically referenced this juror and said there is no such thing as beyond a shadow of a doubt.
So you're casting those as questions to this juror, to which she responded in a way that demonstrated her lack of understanding?
Well, the prosecutor, as I said, again, specifically right after that, referenced her and said, calling her by name, there is no such thing as beyond a shadow of a doubt in the law. possibly indicating that he was not convinced by her prior responses that she did understand the difference, or that she did, in fact, believe that that was the standard that she had to apply here.
And her silence then is to be attributed to her as having a lack of understanding, a further lack of understanding.
Well, again, Your Honor, what the trial court has to determine in step three is whether or not the prosecutor was credible in stating these reasons for the challenge. These reasons on their face were, in fact, race neutral, and obviously we don't need to go over that step of the analysis because we've moved on to step three. But again, the prosecutor, in looking at the entire voir dire, goes back and says, well, look, this juror was confused about this. This was something that the prosecutor also observed and credited and made a finding that this juror did appear to be confused about this beyond a reasonable doubt standard. The prosecutor, or the trial court, also went on to talk about how while there were other jurors who were confused and expressed their confusion or were more engaging with the court, that that did not mean that this juror was not confused. That her way of appearing, while different from these other jurors, did not mean that the prosecutor had not established that she was not confused. And the court said that multiple times in its findings, that just because this juror didn't behave the way these other jurors behaved, that doesn't mean that she wasn't confused. The court, in fact, did find that she was confused here, and that the defendant had not met its burden in proving that there was an unconstitutional use of the peremptory challenge in this case.
Let me ask, does it matter that the prosecutor did not challenge the other African-American?
I don't believe that that's necessarily, I think the court can look at that as a factor, but that's certainly not dispositive to the issue here.
So we focus on this particular juror and whether the reason for it was because of her race.
Certainly. So okay. A pattern is not required,
okay.
Obviously. But again, so I think that the court did go through and did credit the statements by the prosecutor. This is the defendant's burden in the third step, and the trial court made a determination that the defendant had not met his burden and that there was not an unconstitutional use of the peremptory challenge here. Now, to the extent that the defendant is now on appeal asking this court to conduct a comparative analysis, he didn't ask that in the trial court. The defendant made a very general statement that, hey, there were other jurors that were also confused. He didn't ask the court to compare this particular juror's answers to any of the other named jurors that he's now raising on appeal. And I think that the Snyder case that the defendant relies on specifically cautions appellate courts from engaging in a comparative analysis for the first time on appeal when a cold record doesn't indicate whether or not these jurors were in fact similarly situated. And I think that's important, especially here, where we have the defendant talking about one of the prospective jurors who talked about whether or not he could be, whether or not he believed that the sun would rise in the west tomorrow. And immediately following his statement, the defense attorney made multiple statements about, you know, I appreciate the humor. I know some of this is funny. I mean, it's very likely that that particular juror was simply making a joke. I mean, defense attorney made multiple comments that I appreciate the humor. We just need to make sure, you know, I want to have a good time, but let's make sure that we focus on the issues here. And so asking this court for the first time on appeal when we don't have a developed record looking at comparing these specific jurors, again, the Snyder court has really cautioned appellate courts from doing so when we don't have a developed record.
I understand that warning, but are there any other instances in the record where the prosecutor asked what appears to be kind of a trick question of other jurors?
Not that I can recall, Your Honor.
Again, in Miller L., that was identified as one of the concerns when difficult or confusing questions like that are asked of people of one race but not of another.
And again, as I said, I don't know if the prosecutor simply misspoke in this case. And again, the trial court did credit what the prosecutor said here. And the trial court is in the best position to judge the credibility of the prosecutor in this case. He had the benefit of observing his behavior and demeanor during voir dire, and he's in a better position than this court on a cold record to determine whether or not the prosecutor was credible in the reasons that he offered.
But don't we have that lacking? I mean, the court reached the conclusion that it had not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt that, you know, these were racially motivated strikes. But the trial judge never said, and I found the prosecutor's reasons to be credible.
Isn't that missing here?
He didn't use that specific language, but again, if you look at the trial court's ruling and the findings that the court made by crediting the prosecutor's stated reason, by acknowledging that he also observed the confusion on the part of the juror, the trial court was indicating that he credited the reason offered by the prosecutor in this case. And then the court went on to show that to say that the defendant had not established its burden in showing purposeful discrimination here and denied the Batson challenge. So the court followed the proper steps, made the proper determinations, and while it didn't specifically use any magic language to say, I find the prosecutor credible here, that was implicit in the court's findings. And again, if the court finds that the findings were in fact lacking, a remand would be appropriate to allow the trial court to make the necessary findings.
Are there any cases that you're aware of where there's been a remand for further findings on step three? The cases you cited, I think, dealt with step one, where the trial court makes a finding on step one, he or she is reversed on that, mm-hmm. and it goes back. Aren't we kind of stuck with whatever the trial court did on step three at this stage and have to come out one way or the other on that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I don't have a specific case site in front of me, but I believe that any time that the factual findings are lacking, this court can remand for additional findings on that issue, especially when what we're talking about is a credibility determination that the trial court is in the best position to make.
And would that be done? That would be done on the record and from the memory of the judge?
Yes, Your Honor.
And who was the judge who ruled in this particular case? Because I know that Judge Spencer is no longer on the bench.
And Judge Spear was also, I'm not sure who was Spear, I believe.
I think it was Spear.
And so it would be a matter of the judge's memory from back when this case was tried?
Yes, if it can make those determinations, yes. This case was in 2010, so it's not particularly old.
Thank you, counsel. I'm not stopping you if you have more.
Unless the court has further questions, we would ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Mr. Klein?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to actually pick up the remand issue first. Norrell, Snyder, Collins, Gabler, Wilson, all were third step analysis cases, all reversed without a remand for further development of factual findings. In Snyder, the U.S. Supreme Court was very clear that where the record does not show that a trial judge made a determination concerning demeanor, that the U.S. Supreme Court would not presume the trial court credited the prosecutor's assertion about nervousness and reversed without remand for further findings. That exact same year in Collins, this court did the exact same thing and said that where the district court did not make any finding crediting stated reasons, this court would not presume that the trial court had done so. And it was Judge Spear was the trial judge. And as Judge Miller pointed out, in Miller L, the trick question, the more complex death questions, Miller also spent a lot of time talking about that the prosecutor did that with the African-American jurors disproportionately to white jurors. And here, where the prosecutor asked a leading question about something that the trial judge had not said, that is very telling.
Counsel, Miller L is a very, very different case. I think in that situation, 10 out of 11 African-American jurors were struck. There was evidence that the Dallas District Attorney's Office had a manual which said, remove all African-American jurors. I mean, we don't have that kind of a backdrop to this case, do we?
Right. But Collins was not that kind of case, and neither was Wilson or Gabler or Snyder versus Louisiana. So I think, yes, Miller L, there was incredibly strong other evidence that's not present in this case, but is not needed. I am out of time. Unless there are further questions, I would ask that the court reverse Mr. Singleton's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Again, we appreciate the extent of your preparation and your direct responses to our questions. This case is now submitted for decision. We will issue an opinion in due course.